but I want to tell you a word or two about her. She is the current president of Physicians for Social Responsibility and has made an enormous difference as the current president. And she learned to do this in her work as a chair of the PSR chapter in Portland, Oregon. She's a teacher and has put this into our curriculum. She is a remarkable spokesperson for PSR. It's a privilege to introduce Catherine Thomason.
Thanks so much. I appreciate being here and having all of you here to hear about this very important issue. This presentation was created not solely by myself, but also by Dr. Cindy Parker, who's on the National Board of PSR, and her entire presentation, which is longer than this one, is on our website, part of our series on climate and health that you can download and utilize in your outreach on this issue. So, who's been impacted by climate change? All right, you guys know it. I love it. One out of three Americans have been affected by a major extreme weather event in the last 2 years. But we've all been impacted by the increase in temperature, haven't we? So everybody has been impacted by climate change. Now, this may not have led us to violence or to have been the victim of violence, but a lot of these studies have been done in the United States, and we know that increased temperature increases violence. There are well-known, well-studied public health impacts of increasing rates of violence. Those include competition for scarce resources, whether the resources are water or food or electricity. Migration, whether people have to move because of war, which we've heard about, or because of environmental conditions. Of course, there are other factors as well. Is the government adequate to help support and prevent violence within its society or not? Are there significant demographic and economic inequalities? Is there gender inequality? Is there a big youth population that is not employed? These are all factors, along with the abundance of lootable resources like oil and diamonds and the other factors like that. Now, this very, very busy slide probably represents all the things you know about climate change and how climate change is going to impact our resources. So for example, the top one there, sea level will rise. Extreme weather events will increase coastal disturbances, will decrease fishing, so we're going to have loss of food, which will increase population migration, and all of these things will impact violence. Let's look at water specifically. It's estimated that 2.3 billion, or 41% of the entire world's population, lives in water-stressed areas. 25% live in water-scarce areas. That means that a single person has less than 1,000 cubic meters of water per year. We use over 8,000 per year in the United States per person. According to the People and Planet Analysis, by 2025, it's estimated that 48% of the world's population will be suffering from water stress or scarcity. Likewise, everyone needs to eat. Grain yields will decrease by 10% for every 1 degree centigrade in global average surface temperature. So let's look at Syria. I didn't know much about Syria. It had a population of about 22 million. It's the size of North Dakota. It's hot and dry in the summer, rainy and mild in the winter, and actually was a middle-income developing country. It had less people below the poverty line than the United States before the Civil War. That's what I didn't know. 10% of its population were refugees. It accepted refugees, including the Iraqi refugees from the U.S. war, Palestinian and Lebanese refugees as well. However, it did have and does have a repressive government with a significant amount of corruption. That's a picture of a sandstorm up above. So what happened between 2006 and 2011? 60% of the land was affected by a very prolonged drought. In 2007, the height of the drought, 1 million people were affected by over 75% crop loss. Herders sold their animals before they died below cost because they would have died. For the first time in modern history, Syria had to import wheat. Sandstorms were happening up to twice a week. And what did the government do? Well, that's part of the problem. The government did not help the farmers stay on the land. They did not provide aid to keep people back in the land, and so people moved to the cities. So there's higher unemployment, no housing, lots of conflict occurring, and did this cause the Civil War? It certainly was a major factor. There's a new study, a meta-analysis, so we're going to get in a little statistics here, that was put out in Science in September of this year, and I recommend it. It looked at over 60 quantifiable studies, whether they were global, regional, countrywide, province, even citywide. So they looked at these to evaluate the impact of climate on violence, various factors of climate change on violence. They required that these were actually experiments or natural experiments. So in other words, you can't equate a population in New York with a population in North Dakota when you're looking at temperature and rates of interpersonal violence, right? So basically, these studies had to be looking at the same population over a significant period of time and then looking at the variable of the climate factor, whether it was temperature, increased rain, decreased rain, and so on the outcome of either personal violence, intergroup violence, or international violence, internation violence, basically. And so they have very, very elegant graphs, similar to these two here. These two are U.S. studies. The darker and narrower the band is the smaller the confidence interval and the more likely to be statistically significant. The very white line that you can barely discern at the center of that graph indicates the mean. And so the y-axis is the violence. The x-axis is the climate variable, in this case temperature, in both conditions. And, of course, most of us know that increasing temperature increases interpersonal violence. So I'm going to just review some of the summaries from this particular evaluation. Again, more violent behavior tends to occur in high-temperature climates. In low-income settings, extreme rainfall events, particularly when they adversely affect agricultural income, are associated with higher rates of personal violence and property crime. And higher temperatures are associated with increased property crime, but more commonly with violent crimes in general. It's a higher values. In terms of intergroup violence, so say for example in India between Muslims and Hindus, there are increased in at levels of violence in low-income areas when these climate variables occur. Low water availability, very low temperatures from the mean or very high temperatures from the mean. Political conflicts often as well have a direct link to a climate-induced changes of income. So the Syria example. Reports of effect of climate on conflict within this meta-analysis reviewed over 35 studies, actually 60 studies overall, and there are other studies that did not meet the statistical type of study that were used to create this meta-analysis. So again, another example is in Kenya. There are many problems that exacerbate the problems with water scarcity, such as deforestation resulting in more runoff, resulting in less springs and aquifers being regenerated. And there, and as in most places, most of the conflict is actually between groups within the country rather than between countries at this point. So one other factor in looking at climate and violence, and this is kind of the factor that we can get at, obviously, we want to do everything we can to reduce the potential additional climate change that we may get. But there are some other factors that we can also look at and possibly mitigate. So supply-induced scarcity is, for example, increasing populations demand more water, right? The supply-induced is where you don't have enough water because of natural amounts in the aquifer. Population growth or demand-induced scarcity is the second factor. And then the third factor is whether or not the government, the country, the city induces structural. So do people have enough money to pay for the resources? Can they buy food? Can they get water? Do they have to buy that? Obviously, all of those result in increased environmental scarcity, potential migration, expansion, weakened states, and ethnic conflicts, civil wars, and so on. So let's look at the Middle East again. Let's look at Gaza. Most of the fresh water comes from groundwater. It has a low annual rainfall. 60% of that rainfall runs off into the Mediterranean or is lost to evaporation, which of course will increase with higher temperatures. So only 40% is left to recharge the single freshwater aquifer, which happens to be shallow, and 90% is already contaminated by sewage, agricultural runoff, and salt water. So the sustainable supply is about a third of what is needed for the country. So there's a demand-induced scarcity as well, because as the population increases, it needs more water. And there are structural scarcity components as well. There's strict quotas on Palestinian consumption, which have been frozen at 1967 levels. They're prohibited from drilling new wells or repairing water or sewer infrastructure. They pay about 20 times what is required to be paid by Israeli settlers for water. And they have to buy it. So there is actually a desalination plant that provides about 20% of the fresh drinking water over and above the groundwater. The rest have to buy bottled water, and it costs about a third of their monthly income. So, the next time someone says to you, "I don't believe climate change is really happening," quote the State Department, okay? So the State Department has come out with a report, has come out with several reports, and it's taking active measures to deal with what it expects to be outcomes of climate change and violence. Climate impacts are observable, measurable, and real. Failure to anticipate and mitigate these changes will increase the threat of more failed states, with the instabilities and potential for conflict inherent in such failures. These things, and I don't have time obviously to go into them, point us to what we should be doing, okay? We have scarce resources, we know that. We have to create the conditions under which those scarce resources can be shared, involving the community in those decisions, requiring community cooperation between populations that may not always want to get along are always the ways that we solve public health problems. So bringing public health to bear on these kinds of issues is going to be extremely important to prevent failed states. So I exhort you to join an organization that is interested in changing the policy, because we have to change policy. Only by working together, whether you're with another group and collaborating with Amnesty International, who spoke earlier today, IPPNW, PSR, and the other organizations that some of you belong to, working together, we can make policy change. We need to demand it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Catherine. We have time for one question. Are there any questions? If not, I want to thank. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me, please. Bob Gould.
Just one comment, Catherine, and I want to thank you and Cindy for the really excellent presentation, which is not often I'm talking about here. But to reinforce this, as well as the connections back to what I was talking about, there have been a number of reports out of the Institute for Policy Studies by Miriam
The comment I'd like Catherine to comment upon for the recording is that such a small amount of monies and other resources that our country spends on climate security, 1 to 2% or so, compared to military security.
That's absolutely true. It takes so much less for prevention, as any health professional will tell you, than it does for treatment. And in these circumstances, there really isn't any good treatment. So we need to get moving on the prevention. So again, materials are in the back. I encourage everyone to become a member of an advocacy group, whether it's PSR, you don't need to be a P, you just can be anybody, including an HP, any health professional, any citizen who wants PSR and you to work together on these policy changes. We can make the change we need to do. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Dr. Seidel and I would like to once again thank all of our speakers and invite you to come up individually and ask them any additional questions that you have. Thank you for coming.